GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy sending President Biden a letter asking to meet on spending cuts and raising the debt limit. Republican Senate Leader John Thune says it's a good step forward.
The Speaker's letter, frankly, was pretty specific. He laid out four very specific policy suggestions that would represent, I think, common ground.
President Biden says their deal was for each side to lay out their budgets. Authorities haven't yet discovered a motive for yesterday's mass shooting at a Christian school in Nashville. Attorney General Merrick Garland says federal authorities are helping the local police.
Basically, the ATF office just emptied out. Everybody in that office ran to the scene. They and the FBI did as well.
Nashville police say the shooter legally purchased seven guns from five different local stores and hid some of them at home. State Department saying the U.S. will support the creation of a special tribunal to prosecute top Kremlin officials for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. This is ABC News. In a case against the Boy Scouts of America, a federal judge upholding the approval of a $2.4 billion bankruptcy reorganization plan aimed at resolving tens of thousands of sex abuse claims against the Boy Scouts, embattled crypto executive Sam Bankman-Fried, now facing a new charge.
In 2021, Chinese authorities had frozen two of Sam Bankman-Fried's trading accounts on China's largest crypto exchanges. For months, federal prosecutors said Bankman-Fried tried everything to get them unfrozen before finally agreeing to pay a multi-million dollar bribe. He allegedly sent $40 million in cryptocurrency to one or more Chinese government officials. Federal prosecutors have now charged Bankman-Fried with violating anti-bribery provisions of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Aaron Katursky, ABC News, New York.
Honda recalling more than 330,000 Odyssey, Passport, Pilot, and Ridgeline vehicles because heating pads behind the side view mirrors might not be bonded properly and the glass could fall out. Andy Field, ABC News.
Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. They're still trying to find out why a student died at the University of Wisconsin in Madison yesterday. The Vice Chancellor of Student Affairs says it does not appear to be suspicious and that there is no threat to anyone else. The University Police Department and the Dane County Medical Examiner are handling the investigation. The university is also providing support to students who need it. All flags in Wisconsin are at half-staff today to honor a World War II veteran whose remains were only recently identified. Private William Simon was killed in Germany in 1944. In 2019, a government historian suspected unidentified remains at an American cemetery in Germany could be Simon's. That led to a DNA match with his brother and sister. He's buried today in his hometown of Middleton with full military honors. In sports, the Badgers play North Texas in the NIT semifinals tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Kids, they're just different than us. They have no inhibitions, consider silverware optional, and can find fun anywhere. And when kids get really sick, they're different than us too. Until now, children diagnosed with blood cancer have been treated like many adults. Not anymore. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society proudly introduces the Dare to Dream Project, transforming treatment and care through advocacy, education, and the largest global clinical trial for kids with blood cancer. For the first time, a specific treatment can be matched to a specific type of cancer in a specific child. It'll be the biggest medical advancement for little patients in history. Dare to dream with us. Support the Dare to Dream Project and all the work that the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society does at lls.org.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling? I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ad Council and Pivotal Ventures.
Uh-oh, Brad's buzzed.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's starting with the woots. And now a speech.
I just want to say that friendship is about heart. Heart and brain. Who's with me?
Good thing is, he knows when he's buzzed.
And my brain is saying, when it's time to go home, somebody call me a ride.
Love that guy.
Me too.
Know your buzzed warning signs? Call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Moving Day, a walk for Parkinson's, is happening around the country. Together we can unite in the fight against Parkinson's disease in a safe but exciting and fun way. So let's get moving. Join the Parkinson's Foundation to learn more and register at movingdaywalk.org.
Or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start off with Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney had an interesting quote. She said, if we really want to keep our kids safe, we need to spend less time banning books and more time stopping the horrific gun violence in our schools. And you go, yeah. We need to spend more time, figuring out how we stop this craziness. Less time worrying about the books that, this is the part that gets me. We want to arm the teachers. I hear this all over the last day. We need to arm the teachers, more guns in the schools, more teachers with guns. But we're not going to let them decide what books kids read. It's twisted. The president came out and said that he's done everything he can do. He's done everything he can do through executive order. It's Congress's job to act. He said, I have gone the full extent of my executive authority to do on my own anything on guns, about guns. Congress has to act. The majority of American people think having an assault weapon is bizarre, a crazy idea. They're against that. He added, I can't do anything except plead with Congress to act reasonably. Now, this is important. The president's going, look, my hands are up in the air. There's nothing I can do without you, Congress, to do something. Now, you've got this Republican representative from Tennessee, right in the area where this shooting happened. His name's Tim Burchett. Burchett came out and said, it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible, horrible situation, he said, and we're not going to fix it. Criminals are going to be criminals. And it's this kind of just throw your hands up in the air, go, can't stop it. Hopes and thoughts and prayers. Can't stop it. Nothing we can do about it. We're not going to fix it. How did we go from, my generation, we're not going to take it as the anthem to, we're not going to fix it. Nothing we can do about it. And the thing is they want us to believe that we're helpless. They want us to believe that the only defense is more guns, more sales of guns, more people carrying guns, more tragedy, more disaster capitalism. And the thing that I found interesting when he was asked, how is he keeping his children safe? His own daughter. What are you doing? What are you doing with your kids, Representative? He said, well, we've opted to homeschool. And for me, there was this moment, this kind of light bulb moment. And I've said this in the past. These shootings benefit Republicans. It's like they want them because they benefit, because it's good for their agenda. Because they're really never going to fix anything. They're never, never, never going to solve the problem. They're good at pointing it out. They're good at blaming everybody for everything, but they never, never have a solution to fix it. And look, this plays right into their hands. Because I've been saying for a while, all of the attacks that we see on public education, all of it, from the book banning to, the parents go, we want to know what every second of every day, all of this stuff that they've thrown out, defunding, the decades of defunding, the decades of pushing all of these choice schemes that never come up with any choice. And I finally have come to the reality, and I think we as a country have to come to the reality that that Republicans are okay with these shootings. Because it's good for their agenda, which is to destroy public schools. It's to end public schools. Because what happens? What happens? The message is, you should start homeschooling, start pulling your kids out. Now, understand, this was a private school where the shooting in Nashville happened. You don't hear a lot about that. But here we are in this moment. Republicans have done nothing. Democrats keep coming out with plans. We can argue whether they're good, bad, indifferent, but they keep coming up with, hey, this is how we can move in this direction. What I find interesting, Tennessee, where this shooting happened most recently, starting on April 1st, you can bring a loaded gun with you to brunch, but dress up like Dolly Parton? If a man were to dress up like Dolly Parton and sing Jolene, that's going to be a misdemeanor. Someone's going to jail. It's kind of twisted, don't you think? Packing the heat. And the thing that gets me is in the coverage of this most recent one is just mind-blowing to me. Because, again, we're talking the solutions from the writer. We need guns in school. We're going to arm those teachers. We're going to have police officers in every hallway. We're going to set up big sandbags out front with 50 caliber machine guns to barricade our schools. Because that's what they want. This is what the ammosexuals are dreaming. This is what they want. And I think, as John Stewart said, at what point, because we're saturated with guns, at what point do we then become safe? At what point do 3 9-year-olds not get slaughtered? And I was reading an interesting piece over at the Washington Post that are talking about these AR-15 rounds, these high-velocity rounds that, as they said, come in a barrage of 30 or even 100 in rapid succession. They said it can eviscerate multiple people in seconds. A single bullet lands with a shockwave intense enough to blow apart a skull and demolish vital organs. The impact is even more acute on compact bodies of small children. And, the basic takeaway from this is maybe we're at a moment where the carnage of these weapons needs to be shown in public. Maybe we need to start posting, what's happened to these children on billboards, because I don't think we quite get it. But I hear it's not the guns. No, it's not the guns. Now, we've always had people who are going to do bad things. We've always had it. In fact, the good representative who's now homeschooling their kids saying, well, nothing we can do about it. We're not going to fix it. Don't look to us. Don't look to us, because we have no solutions. Is this what has to happen? Now, these weapons, again, I agree. There are bad people who want to do bad things. Always have been. When I was a kid, there were tons of them. These weapons help. And, the tool here is maybe start looking at how we allow someone with a mental health history of this shooter to go and purchase 5 weapons with, take more, have some more, get a 6th. They're fun. And no questions. Now, as I've said in the past, I'm not a gun grabber. In fact, I've got one within arm's reach. But I think you should have sane, rational regulations. There should be red flag laws where someone who is struggling with mental health issues we should be looking into. They shouldn't be easy to get, like, just out of a parking lot at a Walmart. Also, I find it interesting. Many news outlets, I refuse to say the name of any of these shooters, any of these murderers. I will not utter their name. I will not talk about them personally. I do find it interesting. I do find it interesting how the New York Post not only posted a picture, but the person's name. All the media outlets slapping the picture on it. And you got to go, why? What is it about this shooting that the New York Post and other media outlets would violate their own policy? What is it about this one to not show the murderer and name them? What is it about this moment? Well, there's the transgender issue here. And again, this plays into the rights narrative. You know, it's those over there. And the thing that I haven't heard anyone say, because this person was born a female and was transitioning into a male, going, congratulations, this person is now male, doing what males do. Can you tell I'm angry and frustrated in the moment by a congressman saying there's nothing we can do? Yeah, you know, is what it is. Bunker down. Do you accept that? And this is where my mind goes. Do we as a society accept nothing we can do? Because some people don't want to be inconvenienced. My kids have to be at risk every day. 3 9-year-olds are never going to see 10. Because, well, we don't want to do paperwork. We don't want to do background checks. We don't want to do, mental health checks. We don't want to do any of that. So we don't want red flag laws. We don't want to inconvenience anyone's fetish to the firearms. And what's interesting is you have the congressman, Representative Ugles there, whose Christmas card with his whole family, you know, like true homosexuals, posing with their ARs and their weapons. Who does that? A firearm is a tool. And it's a tool for what? It's a tool to murder. Whether you're killing animals for consumption or you're killing people. That's what it was made for. It is a tool. And my Republican friends are saying, sorry, we're going to give this tool to everyone. Even people who are going to do horrible things. And then we're just going to throw up our hands and say, oh, wish we could. Thoughts and prayers. Thoughts and prayers. Want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you think there's something we can do, or is it? Or are we just helpless? Is this a hopeless moment? That we should just in despair, you know, wait for the next time and the next time? Or should we turn our schools and our playgrounds into armed camps? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, I go back to this, and the reality is they're not going to fix it. Just like they're not going to fix public education. This is another in the things that they're telling us outwardly. They don't have a plan. There are no solutions. Again, the Republican Party, all they have is division. All they have is tearing us apart. And that's the sad thing. I want a functional Republican Party. I want people to come to the table with actual ideas and not just, nothing we can do about it. And I look now at all of these so-called parental rights bills. I'm sure you've seen them. A single parent can go into the school library and challenge any book because, well, the book says he or she, because we're against pronouns evidently now. Yeah, I was thinking about it. You think about the power that this one parent has to go in and shut down education. They call it parental rights bills. But how many rights of other parents is this one person usurping? And it's the same thing that, you look down in Georgia, what they did with voting rights. You had one person challenge, 50,000 people's right to vote. And probably 99% of them were wrong. But they did it because they could, because they wanted to gum up the system and slow it down. And again, destroy the system. It's about tearing at the machine. It's not that they could care less about your kids or mine. They've proven this. But it's about gumming up the system. It's about destroying what they ideologically despise, which is anything we the people hold. Anything we the working class, anything we the citizens of this country hold and control and operate. Has to be privatized. Has to be profitized. Has to be in the hands of the elite. While they're saying, public education's in the hand of the elite. No, it's not. Sorry. We vote for our school boards. They have to stand before us and say, hey, this is what we're doing. We can go to meetings and we can, look, they did it. They sent crazy people to disrupt meetings and cause all kinds of chaos under the guise of parental rights. And you find out that half the people that went to those meetings weren't even parents of that school. Because it was all about the display. It was all about the message. It was all about the narrative. That, we're fighting for your parental rights. Don't you want us to make sure your kid never sees that naked statue of David that's been around for, 520 years? Because now it's not just a naked guy with a giant right hand. Message being doing the work of God. No, it's pornographic. Because one person, there were three complaints. Two people said, we would like to have been notified. One person complained. And it is now national nonsense. One official in Wisconsin, in Waukesha, Wisconsin, says, you know what? I don't like Rainbow Land. It could be perceived as something bad. Because it says rainbow. And everyone knows what rainbow means, right? No ideas on how to make lives better. And this is them telling us that they've got no way to help the working class do better, our kids to get better educations, workers to get better jobs. They've got no ideas. There's nothing. They're void of ideas. But what they are is they're bomb throwers. These are people who won popularity contests by being outrageous, by saying how much they hate government, and we're going to show you how much we hate government by not doing a thing. Now, I looked at New Mexico. Their governor, Michelle Grissom, signed a new piece of legislation today, ensuring that every child has free and healthy school meals, everyone, breakfast and lunch for every New Mexico school. Fresh ingredients from local farmers and local growers. See, this is thinking. This is a policy. We're going to make sure that our kids get fed because we know that when kids have full bellies, their minds work a little bit better. And also the local community needs customers. So this is a way to go, hey, local agriculture, we got a market for you. we're going to take some of your product, and it's going to be a great win-win situation. Now, Minnesota most recently became the fourth state in the country to provide universal school lunches for, you know, and breakfast. I shouldn't say lunches. It's breakfast and lunch, so it's both. New Mexico is now the fifth. Could this be something that happens across the country? Hope so. Smart policy, good policy. Going to help kids learn, going to provide a better environment. It's good stuff. Here's the thing that gets me. The amount of money that it would take to feed every one of these children, a mere pittance compared to what my gun friends want to put a gun in every teacher's hand. Where's that money going to come from? Oh, we got money for guns, right? But not for butter? There used to be a socialist president. There was a good socialist president. What was his name? Good Republican socialist president. Dwight David Eisenhower was his name. Gave a speech about guns and butter. When we stop making sure that our kids are taken care of, that are at the baseline fed, there's something wrong with us while proposing more guns. Now, I understand there's a bill in Congress that could do this nationwide, ensure that school meal programs are universal. It's these Universal School Meals Act, free breakfast, lunch, dinner, and a snack to all kids. And this is one of those things where, you know, having myself grown up in a very poor area where, you know, in the summertime, you could get a hot lunch, and again, wasn't much. And Reagan came in and destroyed it. That message for me very young. Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. And especially poor people. Look at the policies. Again, and I'm not just beating up on Republicans. I know Republican politicians from the past. I know a lot of Republican voters. When you talk to them individually, we're all of the same kind of mindset. I've yet to face-to-face meet a Republican voter who's going to tell me flat out, no, we're not going to feed the children. It's when you get this groupthink that it then becomes something that has to fall by the wayside. This is where I keep coming back to. You know, I don't know the three staffers who were murdered in Nashville. I don't know whether they were Democrats, Republicans, Independents. I don't know their immigration status. I don't know whether they're white, black. I don't know anything about them. I know they shouldn't have been murdered. I don't know anything about the three children. I don't know anything about those 3 9-year-olds. But I know they're not going to see 10. And I know their families are heartbroken. And that will never heal. And again, to have someone tell us right out, say, hey, oh, sorry. We're not going to fix it. It's not going to happen. Because the right of, again, read the sentence, the right of the people shall not be infringed. And again, we can argue day and night about the well-regulated militia. We can argue day and night about, you know, the Second Amendment and what its intent was really, really about. But we're in a moment where I don't believe the Founding Fathers really ever could have conceived of the kind of weaponry in the hands of people that can do such horrible things. Now, again, I'm not a gun grabber. I'm not. As I've said, I've got one not more than arm's reach away. But there are sane, rational things we can do and should be doing. And when you have someone like Liz Cheney coming out and saying, you know what, we've got to do something. And look, I'm no fan of Liz Cheney's. But when even she's going, you know, banning books isn't keeping our kids safe. It's time we spend less time banning books and more time stopping these horrific, horrible murders. Is that something we can come together on? Is that something we can take the red hats and the blue hats off and say, you know what? Don't care about the politics. Want to make sure my kid comes home? Want to make sure your kid comes home? Because here's the sad reality. What we know is out of these six people having their lives stolen from them, gun sales are going to go up. The gun manufacturers are going to make more money. The gun dealers are going to make more money. and the Republican Party is going to get stronger because this helps their agenda. There's something wrong with that, don't you think? Love to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day the Three Mile Island Unit 2 reactor partially melted down near Middletown, Pennsylvania. A combination of equipment failure and human error has long been attributed as the cause of the meltdown. An initial overheating and reactor shutdown had occurred, but a pressure valve remained stuck open, allowing coolant to escape. Design flaws in control equipment failed to indicate the position of the valve. Workers then mistook the increased pressure as a result of the excess coolant. They shut off the emergency water system that could have cooled the core. Fears of radiation release and hydrogen bubbles led to voluntary evacuations that included over 140,000 residents. Authorities assured the public that the partial meltdown had been contained. President Carter convened a commission to investigate the causes. It concluded that while the operators took inappropriate actions, the training they received was inadequate, as were the procedures they were required to follow. Plant designers Babcock and Wilcox were held responsible for poor design. The company failed to notify operators of repeated valve failure and a previous near duplicate of the potential catastrophe at the Davis-Bessey plant. Metropolitan Edison, General Public Utilities, and the NRC were also held responsible for poor quality control, poor maintenance, communication lapses, and poor training. Fears regarding public health and safety intensified, fueling health studies of those exposed and the anti-nuclear power movement. The aftermath brought about sweeping changes involving emergency response planning, reactor operator training, human factors, engineering, radiation protection, and many other areas of nuclear plant power operations. It also caused the NRC to tighten and heighten its regulatory oversight. All of these changes significantly enhanced U.S. reactor safety. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
It's always useful in a moment of national urgency to have level-headed experts explain what's happening. Experts like extremist right-wing politicos. For example, when two high-flying banks crashed this month, these screechers flock to blame it all on their latest ideological bugaboo, wokeness. Their loopy contention is that everything bad in our country is happening because such institutions as schools, libraries, corporations, and even banks are responding to America's long history of systemic inequality by pursuing politically correct policies, promoting liberal values like fairness, equality, and diversity. Hello, oppression of the many by the few is in fact a reality in America. Two, pursuit of those liberal values is what makes America historically important. And banks? You're seriously asserting that high finance is now motivated by a liberal share-the-wealth mentality? Yes, indeed, squawk the self-proclaimed knowledgeable ones, singling out the recently failed Silicon Valley Bank. They were among the most woke banks, moaned a GOP lawmaker who specializes in conspiracy theories. Governor Ron DeSantis piled on, barking that this bank, they're so concerned with diversity and all kinds of stuff. Then Donald Trump offered his usual deep assessment, lecturing that the collapse is, quote, what happens when you push leftist woke ideology. Bovine excrement. As has now been documented, these banks were not woke, but greedy, incompetent, and reckless. Worse, our bank regulators had been intentionally put to sleep by a 2018 law that specifically let such banks escape careful public supervision. Guess what? Trump was the one who initiated this disastrous regulatory exemption. Ron DeSantis cheered and voted for it, and the CEO of Silicon Valley Bank led the lobbying campaign to ram it into law. This is Jim Hightower saying, these politicos and profiteers crashed the bank, and now they're trying to put us to sleep with their hokey anti-woke PR stunt.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, yes, needs a headline. He is going to go to the Senate floor on Wednesday and seek unanimous consent on his bill to ban TikTok from the United States. No more TikTok. And here's the thing, and as I said yesterday, kind of tired of the attacks on TikTok because they're not the only one. In fact, of the top five apps in this country, four of them are Chinese. Why is it only TikTok? Seems very curious to me. I mean, we've got direct seller apps from China to U.S. consumers that go past taxation, that go past all kinds of stuff. And I don't hear anything about that. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the situation going on between us and the People's Republic there in China. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come share some thoughts. He's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be with you as always.
So what do you make of Holly? You know, I know this is a grandstand moment. I watched the hearing. Everybody was attacking the TikTok CEO, and rightfully so. But I got to tell you, it seems a little, I don't know, seems a little overblown.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the grand scheme of issues that we have in the U.S.-China relationship catalog, I guess, you know, for me, this is far down the list. I mean, it's important for a set of issues, so I don't want to trivialize it because, you know, you do have concerns about who can see and control the data, right? You have concerns about the content and the fact that TikTok has found ways to, let's say, censor content that Beijing might not like, and then they take it back. But, you know, that's kind of like the default position.
Right.
In addition to just the broader concerns about social media that you can apply to any of these companies,
right?
Whether it's Meta or what have you. Believe me, I have two 15-year-olds, and so I'm pretty terrified of a lot of social media and the impact that it can have on kids. So there's a whole lot of reasons to be concerned, for sure, but that shouldn't be the only thing that sucks up all the oxygen in the room with concerns about China, because we have other concerns that are, you know, in a lot of ways, life and death, or about economic security, or about whether or not we're going to have a conflict, an armed conflict with China. And TikTok's not going to set that off. A lot of these other issues could. And so, but, you know, politicians are going to do what they're going to do. And TikTok's sexy, and it has 150 million subscribers. And there is that built-in thing where there is a lot of U.S. competition. And so, you know, if they want to do it, if they want to ban it, you know, let's get it over with. But let's, you know, that can't be the last thing that they do on U.S.-China relations, because otherwise it'll just be for naught. And then just the last thing I'll say, Rick, is the way, obviously TikTok's not a manufacturer, and so it's not a direct concern for like our stakeholders. But there is this issue of reciprocity, right? And so TikTok has this unlimited access to the U.S. market, basically. And our digital media companies do not. Either right. They're censored, or they have restrictions placed on them, or they don't have any access to it in the case of like YouTube and a couple of the others. So to me, I mean, do we want to censor like Beijing does? No, but we should at least insist on some reciprocity.
No, no. The reason I bring it up to you, Scott, is not because you're an expert on TikTok, but because four of the top five apps that are being downloaded in the U.S. are Chinese-based. Two of them, this Temu that I keep seeing on my feed all the time because you mentioned it the last time, and I think my computer heard it, so it's just constantly hitting me. And
I'm sorry. And I'm sorry I screwed up your algorithm, man. I'm sorry.
And the Shein app, again, these are direct to consumer from China, kind of production things. How come I'm not hearing about that? I was concerned about all of it.
You can get like some $10 denim booty shorts on Shein if you're looking for them, by the way. So I don't know if they've marketed your way, but in all seriousness, I mean, the reason why Temu and Shein are incredibly important are that, again, this is about reciprocity, access, and an unfair advantage. Temu sells stuff direct to American consumers at really impossibly low prices. I mean, I saw like a piece of hardware on there that cost like $1.50 or something like that, that there's no way you could even find the materials for that. right, to do it for $1.50. It's like impossible. And the same with the garments on Shein. And the reason why they do this, first of all, is that there's some sketchy supply chains in China. We know that. You know, either they involve forced labor or exploited labor. A lot of the stuff is pirated, you know, number two. And then third, the way that they're selling in the United States is to take advantage of this loophole called de minimis, which is Latin basically for bupkis, or it doesn't amount to anything, or it's so small, or so trivial, it doesn't matter. And de minimis is an exception we have in our customs law for people who travel overseas and are bringing back some stuff from overseas so they don't have to pay tariffs on it, basically. But it's limited. It's like $800 or something like that. But, and here's the thing, a whole bunch of companies figured out a loophole when it got opened up that they can sell goods directly to American consumers. They can avoid tariffs, which sometimes are 25%, sometimes more than that, sometimes a little less than that. And they avoid customs inspection, which means they don't have to meet the forced labor requirements necessarily, or there's no way to enforce them, I should say. And so it gives these companies an unfair advantage against all of our online retailers who are doing business in the United States and our bricks and mortar stores as well. And you can decide if you want to buy imports or not. But, you know, if you're going to buy them, they ought to at least go through the process where there's tariffs applied and where they're inspected for things like forced labor or coming from Xinjiang, the Uyghur region.
Or look, if they're going to kill you, you know, they're made with lead or, you know, the melamine and the baby food or all the, you know, all of the things that we've seen time and time again, there's a problem here. And again, we can spend all day on TikTok and the disaster that it is for our democracy and all of that stuff. But the reality is the focus has all been there. And I guess, you know, when we looked at them focusing on Twitter and Facebook in the past, nothing got done.
Yeah,
and I don't expect anything to get done other than the dog and pony show when there are real problems. And I thought it was important to bring that up because I don't think most people think about it.
You know, and one last thing about that, because, I mean, unless you're in manufacturing or in one of the communities that has a factory, you probably didn't experience the China shock very much, right? That a lot of these industrial communities did. And they came in with these state-owned enterprises. They wiped out the competition. Imports flooded in. A lot of our factories closed down. It devastated a lot of folks. But it didn't get nearly as much media attention. So what's happening now is that these digital sellers are doing the same thing. You know, they're coming in. They have this unfair advantage. They're taking a lot of market share from these other retailers, and they're doing it in a way that's really unfair. And of course, consumers are like, you know, if they, you know, unless they have some ethical principles that are applying to this, they're like, this is great. Yeah. I can get this, you know, this t-shirt for like $5. It comes the next, this is awesome. What's not to like about it? But the problem is at the back end of this, there are a lot of consequences. There are economic consequences. It's about equity. And then the exploitation that's happening in China to make it all possible.
And what's interesting to me is there was a study over, there was a report over at AP, the AP that I found interesting. It was titled Amid Strained U.S. Ties, China Finds Unlikely Friend in Utah. And it's this story about, you know, how the Chinese are really drilling down to the local level and, you know, basically buying off local politicians. And I shouldn't say that. That's unfair. They're greasing the palms and schmoozing and bringing, you know, local jobs and stuff to where they're building relationships that now, well, since we're seeing this talk of national divorce, the Chinese are going to come trying to horn in. Are you surprised? I don't think so.
No. And I mean, look, this is something that adversaries have done over the course of our history in the United States. So it's certainly not a new tactic. And frankly, it's not very sophisticated, right? I mean, it's pretty, you know, it's pretty much true to form. And this started, and there's a couple variations of this. First, it was these things called the Confucius Institutes, which were on university campuses, which were funded by, you know, basically friends of the CCP. And, you know, theoretically, they were designed to enhance U.S.-China relationships and the understanding of China. In reality, they were set up to be a mouthpiece for the CCP, to stifle the speech of dissent, and to say to universities, if you're going to allow this to happen, we're going to pull the money from you for all these programs that we've endowed. And so, you know, a lot of these Confucius Institutes disappeared when the strings were attached and these were exposed. There's this other group called the United Front, which is part of what was operating in Utah. And again, the United Front utilizes both Chinese nationals or others who are friendly to the CCP to conduct this at the civic, at the business, at that kind of level. And you can see, and that news story about Utah was a good example about how, if you're naive, that you're going to get suckered into this stuff. And they're essentially foreign agents of a competitor and an adversary, and so it is problematic. It has to be exposed. And this is far, far away from all that McCarthyism BS. And just because someone is a Chinese national doesn't mean that they're involved with this. I want to be very clear about that. But we should insist that United Front and folks related to them are identified so that folks know what is happening here, that it's not just goodwill that is being sought.
And this is where I want elected leaders to be a lot more thoughtful than, oh, we're just going to ban TikTok and it's going to solve all our problems. Because that appears to me to be the rhetoric that we're coming away with. Well, we just ban TikTok, everything will be great. No, it's much, much deeper than all of that. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with Scott Paul. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, the website, if you want to check out the incredible work they do. I do want to ask you about the president kicked off Investing in America tour today in North Carolina. I do find it interesting that he came out and said, look, Republican policies would surrender the tech economy to China. It seems like, and look, I don't disagree with him wanting to defund some of the plans and some of the policies that they're pursuing. Is this a good thing, you think?
Yeah, I am someone, and I know we've talked about this before, that, you know, what happens particularly with Democrats, because they tend to talk about issues rather than values too much, is that, oh, we have this policy. And we did this, and we did this infrastructure, we did this clean energy manufacturing, we did the semiconductor stuff, let's check the box and let's move on to the next thing. And the reality is, most people, unless they're really plugged in, aren't even aware that any of this is happening or what it means to their future or to their communities. And so to have, you know, at the cabinet level and at the leadership level, at the presidential level, Joe Biden and the cabinet out there saying, look, this is the results of all of this. You're getting a 5,000 person factory that's being built here. That's going to keep this place prosperous for a generation. Or this is, you know, we're connecting broadband so that your kids are going to have more opportunities. And to be very specific about the types of investments that are being made and what the outcomes are going to be for people, and also what the consequences would be if these were wiped off the books, I think is critically important. Because so far, and look, we're just getting into this, really. We're only a year and a half, not even a year and a half into infrastructure, and not even a year into chips or the clean energy manufacturing. And you've already seen more than $400 billion of private sector investment that's come about as a result of these federal policies. And so what a great return on investment that, way better than any of these tax cuts that just lead to stock buybacks and other stuff like that. I mean, this is spades in the ground. These are construction jobs. These are going to be manufacturing jobs. It can be capabilities so we don't run into the supply bottlenecks that we saw before on semiconductors. And it's going to bring more people clean water and high-speed internet and all sorts of goodness. And so I'm glad, but they can't do this enough,
right?
I think. I mean,
no,
hopefully, yeah, they need to do this from now until, you know, they run out of breath, basically, because, you know, otherwise, you know, people are going to be focused, again, on the things like the TikTok or the Trump controversy of the day. But just working this, I think, is going to be very, very important to the success not only of the policies, but to keep these going. And Rick, you're right, to talk about the threats if this goes away. You know, if restrictions are put on the funding or whatever, you're really ceding the ground to China. Huge mistake.
No, and you know, I've had a couple of people email me, a couple of Trump supporters, full disclosure, who are saying that this is starting the next war. That because we're defending our manufacturing, because we're wanting to reshore manufacturing, that we're actually agitating China to start the next world war, because you know, you saw the Wall Street Journal, you know, said, you know, chip makers have to choose between the US and China, because we're going, look, we're reshoring this stuff. We're going to start making our own. And so let me put it that way. Do you think that this is heightening tensions that could lead down that path? And if it is something that potentially could, shouldn't we be doing it faster?
Yeah. I completely disagree that this inevitably brings the U.S. and China closer to conflict. I think capitulation brings us closer to conflict, because if they see a U.S. that doesn't have the capabilities or that doesn't have the resolve, they're much more likely, and by them, I mean the Chinese Communist Party and the military, to do things that are going to be even worse than building islands in the South China Sea. You know, and that's stuff that we don't want to see. But if they know we're going to be stronger, we're going to be more capable, and we have resolve, they're far less likely to do stupid things. It doesn't mean that it won't happen, but I think it makes it far less likely. And I mean, when has capitulation worked?
Exactly.
That's what I want to know. I mean, you can give me their names afterwards. Be happy to have a conversation with them, because, you know, if you open up any chapter of history in the world, capitulation has literally never worked. So, you know, if handing the keys to our economy or the technology race, that is a really dumb idea.
I'm right there with you, Scott. I appreciate the time. As always, good stuff. Hope folks will check out the website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott Paul, thanks so much for taking time for us.
You bet, Rick. Keep up the great work. Great to be with you.
Our good friend Scott Paul. Again, check out the website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott's the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Have the talk.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1977. That was the day that members of AFSCME Local 1644 began their unsuccessful strike in Atlanta, Georgia. The union was made up of 1,300 mostly black sanitation workers. The city of Atlanta had elected its first black mayor, Maynard Jackson, in 1973. According to historian Manning Marabell, members of the sanitation union had campaigned aggressively to help Jackson become mayor. Many thought he would be sympathetic to the needs of working people in the city. The sanitation workers' hopes were disappointed when they received no raises for 3 consecutive years. Their average income was $7,500 annually. This put the workers below the city's poverty line. Since the Memphis sanitation workers' strike of 1968, AFSCME had emphasized organizing black workers in southern cities. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated while he was in Memphis supporting the strikers. As the nation mourned the death of the civil rights leader, the Memphis strikers had won their first contract. But the sanitation workers in Atlanta would not win their work action. On April 2nd, Mayor Jackson fired the striking workers. He aligned himself with what Manning Marabell has described as Atlanta's corporations, media, and the leaders of the black party's bourgeoisie. Some black leaders publicly criticized the workers for striking against the city's first black mayor, accusing them of undermining hard-won black political power. The city's black middle class, by and large, did not support the strike. After a month, the strike was effectively over. Workers returned to their jobs with no improvements in their wages, hours, or conditions. And the hard-learned lesson that what politicians say at election time is not always what they do once they get elected. Like what you hear? Check out laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, evidently, Chipotle in Portland, Maine, they have agreed to pay $240,000 in, they're calling it a settlement. It's more like back wages. During a unionization drive, they illegally shut down the location where the people tried to organize. And this, again, shows just how weak our laws are, because this is a big thing. Right now, it's a big deal that a company shut down a location that was unionizing, and there's actually a penalty going to happen. Generally, doesn't happen that way, to show you how weak our laws have gotten and why we do need major comprehensive labor law reform. But the NLRB ruled that it was illegal for them to shut down. And this is where, you know, the penalties should be really stiff. Just $240,000, the back wages for the time, pennies to a company like Chipotle. And they admitted this. They said that, you know, the company doesn't, you know, we don't agree with what, you know, any of the decisions, because, of course, they're never going to. But they're going to settle because it would be cheaper. You know, it's a burdensome, and it's expensive to fight these kind of things. So we'll just pay the pittance, you know, post the notice, the dreaded notice that we won't do it again until the next time. And, you know, everybody will be happy. And I'm like, the penalty should be much worse than this. And had we passed something as weak as the Employee Free Choice Act back during the George W. Bush years and into the Obama years, had we done that, that $240,000 would have been tripled, because they sought to triple the penalties. Now, does that make it a little more painful? I don't think so for a company as large as Chipotle. But here we are. And as I understand, Chipotle still has 10 more other unfair labor practices that are going on as we speak. So, you know, a couple of pennies here, a couple of pennies there. But you know what they don't have? They don't have workers with representation. And this is what corporate America is used to. They're used to having the power. And if they have to pay a little bit, they get to write it off. It cost of doing business. At some point, there need to be real penalties. And this is one of those moments, I think, that, you know, while it's great that they're going to get their back pay for the time that they missed, it's not enough. Just my thoughts. I got an email from John, and I want to make sure I get to this. John, a brother Teamster from Indiana, wrote, "My Teamster local here in Indiana just had a contract proposal meeting, local 364 in northern Indiana. Thanks so much for tuning in, guys. We are a City of Goshen public employees. Great turnout, and we're going after the city for 17.5% increase. We've taken 3.5% the last 3 years, took nothing during COVID. We know we won't get that, but police, fire, and the central garbage have all gotten at least that." John writes, "I work for the city street department. We stand in the road every day risking our lives." He says, "Indiana is a terribly Republican-run state, and they can dissolve the union at any time. But we got to strike while the iron is hot. I would appreciate if you read this on air. It's all or nothing now, because the power of the Teamsters in a right-to-work state. Thanks for all you do for the union class, John." And this is the kind of stuff that you get in no rights-at-work states, like Indiana. This is stuff that you see in places like Florida, where they want to be able to dissolve a union whenever it falls below 50%, because, hey, if the employer can go, hey, you get all those benefits for free, why would you pay the union? You know, you get the freeload off of your brothers and sisters there. You know, you can easily divide up the workforce. You know, you're getting the milk for free. Why would you buy the cow? You know, that kind of mentality. It is Indiana, right? And I hear guys like John going, look, you know, right now is the time. We've not gotten the respect and the dignity that we earn. We are not making the wages that we earn. We're putting our lives on the line to provide a service for the public. We've earned the right to have a living wage and the right to support our families. And It's not just John and Goshen. It's every worker in this country. And the sooner we can all stand together and stand up and fight back and demand better.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the ABC Civic Media News app.